From Punxsutawney to York, Winbur to Williamsport, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the Paycheck Protection Program, designed to help businesses through COVID-19 shutdowns, specifically excluded labor unions. So why did 223 of them receive PPP funds? Max Nelson from the Freedom Foundation is here to discuss. Pittsburgh's North Shore Connector opened 10 years ago, and it remains a drain on public transportation finances. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have an Allegheny Institute report. And inflation is at a 40-year high and represents the true cost of federal government overspending and policies. Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, has a Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Max Nelson of the Freedom Foundation in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. The Commonwealth Foundation is disputing a report by the Manhattan Institute that cited Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers, which seem to indicate public sector labor union membership grew in Pennsylvania by almost 100,000 members. But the Commonwealth Foundation points out their research indicates public sector union membership is declining year over year. Both think tanks, however, agree that union membership reporting and transparency is lacking. Union membership nationwide has been declining in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's Janus ruling, which held workers cannot be forced to join a labor union as a condition of employment. Pennsylvania created an inheritance tax in 1826 to build a canal connecting Lake Erie to the Ohio and Susquehanna rivers. Those canals are long gone, but the inheritance tax remains. According to the Center Square, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania received about $1.2 billion in revenue from the inheritance tax last year. The tax ranges from 4.5% to 15% and affects all inherited wealth in the state. Paying the tax hits small businesses and family farms especially hard, forcing many to sell or downsize to pay the tax. It also encourages migration to other states, such as Florida, which do not have an inheritance tax. You likely will not see chickens and other poultry at your county fairs this summer. A nationwide outbreak of the avian influenza has led the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture to place a temporary ban on the display of poultry and eggs at county and local fairs throughout the state. The ban is in effect for 60 days, but likely will last longer depending on the severity of the outbreak. You will, however, be able to see the usual displays of other livestock, including cows, horses, and pigs. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. As the federal and state governments forced businesses to close during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, Congress passed the Paycheck Protection Program to help weather the storm. A new report by the Freedom Foundation finds hundreds of labor unions may have improperly benefited from those funds. Here with details is Max Nelson. He is Director of Labor Policy at the Freedom Foundation. Max, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Max, when we talk about PPP loans, this, of course, a product of congressional action during the COVID-19 pandemic. Give us a bit of background and some detail on what PPP loans are.
The Paycheck Protection Program was part of the CARES Act, which was passed by Congress in March of 2020 in the early days of the COVID pandemic. And it was the first major congressional action that was taken to offset the economic effects of COVID-19, and particularly the government-imposed shutdowns, lockdowns that were happening around the country at that time. The Paycheck Protection Program was administered by the Small Business Administration, and the goal of the program was to make forgivable loans to small businesses, defined basically as any employer with 500 or fewer employees. And the purpose of making these loans was to allow these businesses, these small businesses around the country, to keep people on payroll and to keep people on staff and avoid mass layoffs, again, to help people navigate through the lockdowns that we were all experiencing and living through at that time. The program was renewed and expanded and modified over the years, but that was the origin and the purpose of the funds initially. Now, as long as the loan recipient used the money in accordance with the purpose of the program and put it towards payroll and other types of expenses that were particularly authorized, then the applicant was able to go back to the Small Business Administration later and seek the forgiveness of the loan. So essentially, in the majority of cases, these were government grants, federal government grants going out to small businesses to help them weather the COVID pandemic.
Was there any definition in that program, Max, as to what a small business is, what constituted, what type of activity the business had to be engaged in?
Not generally. I mean, there were certain criteria, of course, but generally, if you were a business enterprise of any kind and you had employees on staff, again, fewer than 500 employees, then you were eligible to participate in this program. There were some other criteria, the economic factors and whatnot that you had to show as part of your application. But there were some groups, some types of organizations that were still not covered by the Paycheck Protection Program during the first year of its existence, particularly most types of nonprofit charitable organizations. 501c3 groups, which are primarily charitable in nature, and probably a lot of people are familiar with many types of common charities, which are designated as 501c3s. But there were other types of nonprofit organizations that were not eligible to participate in the Paycheck Protection Program. For example, 501c4 organizations tend to be more advocacy-oriented. They were not eligible to participate. 501c5 organizations, labor unions, are technically nonprofit corporations, but they were not eligible to participate. 501c2 building corporations and a number of others were excluded from this program.
You specifically mentioned that labor unions under the 501c5 designation were not permitted to participate in this. However, you've done significant research, and your research has found that, in fact, there were many labor unions across the country that did participate in the program.
That's exactly right, Loman. We put out a research report in February of this year that looked at the one-year period from March 2020 to March 2021 during which labor unions were not eligible to participate in the Paycheck Protection Program. And we identified as many as 223 unions nationwide, or unions or related entities, that nonetheless applied for and received, in some cases, multiple Paycheck Protection Program loans, forgiven loans, essentially grants at that point, totaling over $36 million. Among the unions we identified were about a dozen teachers unions, which I find particularly ironic since teachers unions were some of the biggest advocates for lockdown policies around the country and kept that pressure on as long as they possibly could because they wanted to be able to extract concessions from state and local and even federal policymakers for allowing teachers to return to school. But also on the list were other types of government unions, public sector labor unions, state workers, and municipal government employees and others that, again, were not particularly hit hard as a rule by the pandemic. The federal government provided hundreds of billions of dollars in separate COVID relief directly to state and local governments. And many of those governments are experiencing budget surpluses now and enacting tax cuts or going on spending sprees because they have so much money they don't know what to do with it. So from a policy standpoint, it's really not a good argument to be made that these unions needed the funds because, again, their members, by and large, remained employed throughout the pandemic.
We are talking with Max Nelson. He is Director of Labor Policy at the Freedom Foundation. He has published a report here on Paycheck Protection Program loans utilized by labor unions, which apparently specifically were excluded from that program. In Pennsylvania, Max, how many labor unions and how much money were involved in this program?
In Pennsylvania, we identified 10 labor unions and related funds that are union-operated that received Paycheck Protection Program loans for which they were not apparently eligible. One of the largest of the recipients was actually the Pennsylvania affiliate of the AFL-CIO, which it's essentially a trade association for unions, if you will. AFL-CIO itself does not represent workers in bargaining with employers. It represents the interests of unions. as entities. So essentially, it's an advocacy organization. It tends to be very, very political, more so than providing representational services. It received a Paycheck Protection Program loan of $267,000. So all told, between these 10 unions we identified, they received about $1.2 million in funds that it doesn't look like they were eligible for.
All of this has now caught the attention of the ranking members of a number of committees in the U.S. House of Representatives. That's the big development in the last couple of weeks. Give us a little bit of background on what's happening there.
As you mentioned, Lohman, you know, our report came out in February. Now, here in April, we're starting to see some members of Congress taking note. The ranking members, ranking GOP members on the House Education and Labor Committee, the Small Business Committee, the Health, Employment, Labor, and Pensions Subcommittee, and the Oversight and Regulation Subcommittee have all written to the Small Business Administration's director asking for to provide more information about this breakdown and try to document how bad was it. What led to this problem? What led to unions that weren't eligible getting these loans anyway? And what are you going to do about it, essentially? So we haven't heard yet or seen a response yet from the Small Business Administration, but hopefully it is not too long before we get a better idea about how they're going to handle this. When we put out our research in the first place in February, we did submit our information to the Inspector General at the Small Business Administration, who's an independent official who's tasked with overseeing SBA operations, and has done some very good work already on the Paycheck Protection Program and uncovered other flaws in the SBA's handling of that particular program. But as far as I know, this was not on the Inspector General's radar previously. At least nothing publicly has come out about it. So hopefully the appropriate federal officials are taking a look at this and seeing what they can do to recover these funds that were improperly paid, and if fraudulent applications were submitted, to prosecute those as appropriate.
President Biden, of course, considers himself to be the most pro-labor union president in history. I suppose that means there's not much chance that the U.S. Justice Department's going to get involved here?
Well, that's an interesting question, Lohman. You know, during the President Biden's State of the Union address earlier this year, he specifically stated that his administration was going to be looking into COVID-19 relief fraud specifically, and the Department of Justice already has a National Center for Disaster Fraud, whose job it is ostensibly to ferret out exactly this type of activity. So we have submitted our research also to the Department of Justice's National Center on Disaster Fraud, and if they're doing the job that allegedly they're supposed to do, they should be taking a very close look at this.
Well, we'll certainly keep an eye on that, as we have been talking with Max Nelson, who is Director of Labor Policy at the Freedom Foundation. And Max, tell us a little bit about the Freedom Foundation, and also, is there a place folks can go to read your report on this issue?
The Freedom Foundation is a nonprofit public policy advocacy and public interest litigation group. We're based out in Washington State, but we have offices around the country. And we spend our time holding government unions accountable and representing public employees whose rights have been violated by government unions and ensuring that unions are playing by the rules and following campaign finance regulations and so on. So that is a problem in many states. It's a problem at the federal level, as this recent research shows. But those who may have an interest in reading more about our report here can navigate to our website at freedomfoundation.com. That's freedomfoundation, all one word, .com. We've got a link to it right there on the homepage. All straightforward stuff. We got the complete list of all these unions that we've identified if you want to look through that and see where this money may have gone in your state. And it's all available on our website, freedomfoundation.com.
Max Nelson of the Freedom Foundation. Max, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Lohman.
It was an expensive boondoggle to build and remains a drain on public transportation finances 10 years later. It is Pittsburgh's North Shore Connector. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi explain on this Allegheny Institute report.
Hello and welcome to the Allegheny Institute report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm your host, Frank Gamrat, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Eric Montardi. One of the things that is here that we've been dealing with for quite some time is what locally is known as a North Shore Connector. It was an extension of Pittsburgh's light rail system and runs over towards the stadium area. And could you please give our listeners a quick history of that system?
Sure thing. The reason we wrote about it recently because it was the 10th anniversary of the opening of the connector, but it went back quite some time. It was studied back into the 1980s through the 1990s as part of possible extension out to Oakland and the university area. And eventually what was settled upon was extending the system from where it ended in the Golden Triangle, which over to the north side as well as to the convention center. And they came up with a bunch of different proposals of how to get across the river from existing bridges to new bridges. And finally, what they decided was they were going to tunnel underneath the Allegheny River. And that's what was proposed to the federal government. That was where the project started. And the Institute, looking back through its archives, it wrote about it as early as 2001. At that point, the project was estimated about $360 million. It proceeded through the various stages of federal approval, review, design, engineering, so on and so forth. And when it got to what you would think of as federal approval, meaning the federal government said, we are going to give this project money, the price tag was $435 million. After that, costs went up. The amount of money for the tunneling under the river went up, inflation, so on and so forth. They moved money from other sources to the project to keep it going. There was stimulus money back then, 2009, 2010, the stimulus money that was passed then. And eventually the price tag, when it was all said and done, was $517 million. And that, again, 80% of the money came from the federal government. And that is why there was an attitude or an outlook locally by a lot of the people from the county, from the city, from the Port Authority, that if we don't build this, we're going to lose this money. Yeah. They're going to take it and give it to somebody else. So the project was built. It was open to the public, as I mentioned, in March of 2012. And then the interesting aspect, wrinkle, curveball, whatever, that came with it, I guess two of them, you know, the biggest ones were, one, they ended the connection to the convention center because they felt that they could not afford that part, but that's where a lot of the ridership number was drawn from. And then right before the thing was open, the county and the Port Authority and the city and other various authorities and parties came together to extend what is called the free fare zone. You know, ever since the trolley was built in the 1980s, if you wanted to ride within downtown, within the Golden Triangle from stop to stop, you wouldn't pay a fare. And what they decided to do then was they would get these sponsorship agreements in order to extend the free fare zone across the river. So if you're riding from downtown to the North Shore or back, you didn't pay a fare. And that is true to this day as we speak. It looks like that's going to be extended maybe another 2 years. Beyond that, who knows?
So the timings look very curious. You know, 2001, of course, this thing went across the river, under the river, and over towards where PNC Park just happens to be, where the Pirates play, and then circles over to where Heinz Field is, where the Steelers happen to play. Of course, those two stadiums are built with public money. Convention Center redone with public money, and that was the one that got left out of the cold, really, because it just didn't go that way. And that's where the population center was, because by the convention center, you have that strip district neighborhood where you have a lot of people living. That would have added to it. But despite the change and the reduction in potential ridership, it's still got the green light. Very little has been done study-wise because it's an extension as far as who's using it. However, in your research, you did notice that in 2016, the Federal Transit Administration did a before and after study of the leg of this. And what did they find?
They found, looking at 1 month, they did March of 2016, where they did an extensive detailed survey. And they found that about 11,100 people had used that segment. When they broke that down even further, they said that about 7,400 of those trips were between the North Shore and downtown within the free fare zone. That somebody might have been parking on the north side at one of the garages, getting on the trolley, taking over to downtown. If you look at it, 64% of those trips overall were from what they called home to work. 22% were home to non-work, and 14% of them non-home to non-home. The rest of those trips out of the 7,400, the 1,500, the FTA described them as that they were going from the North Shore, but they originated somewhere south of the Allegheny River, which that still could be downtown. That might mean that's outside the free fare zone. That could be what is Station Square, which is across the Monongahela River, or out into the South Hills. Just assuming that meant that about 67% of those rides that took place in that month in 2016 were within the free fare zone.
Isn't it true that there was a U.S. senator that actually held up the this extension as a complete waste of money?
Yeah, in 2010, there, and again, this was when the stimulus money was passed, that there was a report that was put out. It's actually by two U.S. senators, and they went through what they felt was the worst uses of the stimulus money. And I think the North Shore Connector rate ranked third on that list. But you remember around that time, there was a lot of talk about the bridge to nowhere.
Yeah.
This was called the tunnel to nowhere. The former governor had said it was a mistake, but it probably had to be finished. That's where we are now. The project was finished. Again, a lot of the things, besides the convention center league, I mean, that was the biggest thing, but there were supposed to be more light rail cars that were added. There was going to be a third station on the North Shore at one point. All those things kind of went to the wayside as they went through the engineering and design on the project.
We know that when we added to the light rail system, obviously it raised cost of operation. Look, it would be one thing if the riders were there, but obviously, as everyone knows, 2020, the pandemic hits, ridership has gone down because, let's face it, downtown's been gutted of businesses as folks have decided to work from home. How has ridership been since the pandemic, and what do you see going forward?
Since the pandemic, if we look at the latest data, which would be for February of 2022, if you compare that to February of 2019, average daily light rail ridership is down 79%. If you look at what happened in the year 2019-20, with the National Transit Database, it looks at operating expenses for light rail. It looks at unlinked trips, vehicle revenue hours, which is when the vehicles are in service that possibly that they can have riders and accept fares where they would. Those indicators of operating expense per trip and operating expense per hour, they had been climbing ever since the first full year when the connector opened. So if you go back to 2012-2013, that was really the low point for operating expense per trip and operating expense per hour. Every year since, it has climbed each year. And where we stand right now, as of the most recent data, the operating expense per trip was $12.48 on the light rail system, and the operating expense per hour was $468.39, which, again, both of those are well in excess of where the system was before it opened and where it was right after the connector opened.
And again, keep in mind that a lot of this, there's a lot of the free fare zones, a lot of folks are riding on this thing through downtown Pittsburgh and over the north side. They're not paying anything. They're not covering the cost of the fare, certainly. And so this comes down onto the shoulder of the taxpayers. And in this case, it'd be Pennsylvania taxpayers, because Commonwealth taxpayers pay for public transit as well. This is really good stuff. I'd like to thank my colleague Eric for joining me today. I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in. If you'd like more information on this or other topics, please visit our website at AlleghenyInstitute.org.
Runaway inflation is the true cost of Washington, D.C.'s overspending, and especially the Biden administration's energy policies. So says Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
On April 6th, Americans for Prosperity launched our True Cost of Washington campaign, designed to educate Americans across nine states about the truth behind rising costs while offering real solutions to make everyday life more affordable. The bottom line is that inflation will cost Americans an extra $5,200 this year. The average American household will pay $1,433 more for gas and will spend $430 more on groceries this year. It's wasteful Washington spending and regulations that limit the supply of goods, resulting in us paying more and getting less. Voters are feeling the impact, and 83% say they are experiencing some hardship due to increased prices on everyday items. Unfortunately, Washington's rampant spending shows no sign of abating. President Biden's recent 2023 budget would hike federal spending by $1.5 trillion over the next decade, on top of the trillions more that congressional leaders are eyeing as part of an incremental separate partisan spending bill later this calendar year. But meanwhile, roughly $700 billion from Congress's previous COVID relief bills remains unspent. Together with the ongoing supply chain crisis, a crisis caused by a surge in demand due to government spending coupled with regulations restricting consumer access to goods and energy, Americans are trapped in a perfect storm of economic calamity. It's easy for politicians to blame these rising costs on geopolitical instability or scapegoat corporate greed. But the reality is, out-of-control government spending and burdensome regulations have been fueling the problem all along. We know that now is not the time for half measures that only temporarily mask the pain. Our country needs to completely reimagine how to make life more affordable for everyday Americans. AFP believes that the best way to do that is through policies that, among other things, unleash energy abundance, end wasteful spending, and cut the red tape that keeps prices high. We'll dig into each of these over the coming weeks, but today we'll address energy. A number of policy decisions have hindered our ability to build and supply reliable and affordable energy in the U.S. As a result, Americans spend over $1.22 trillion per year on energy. More than 30 million households face high energy burdens and pay a substantial portion of their take-home pay for electricity, heating, and fuel. Second, it takes between 4 to 6 years to finish the environmental review process for energy and infrastructure projects. And last, we have some of the same nuclear energy capacity in the U.S. as we did in the 1990s. The average age of our nuclear reactors is 38 years old. To make energy more affordable, we need to focus on three things. First, we must prioritize reforms to reduce energy burdens, such as Strategic Production Response Act. This bill would make sure the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is not tapped as a solution for poor policy decisions and would lead to increased oil and gas production on federal lands. Second, we must remove barriers to energy innovation, infrastructure, and environmental progress. The Unshackle Act is a good first step to reforming and changing the National Environmental Policy Act. And third, we must reject the Paris Climate Agreement. In doing so, Congress can reclaim its constitutional role regarding treaty ratification. So please visit www.truecostofwashington.com and email your legislators now and let them know that removing antiquated regulations, creating energy abundance, and stopping out-of-control spending must be their priority. We are grateful for your partnership in scaling these critical policy solutions. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania. Find us on Facebook by searching at PAAFP and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 27 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WPGM-FM in Danville, WWEC-FM in Elizabethtown, along with WCED-AM in Dubois, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
The top of 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 the top of